Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Climate Change in the Multiverse. I'm your host, Kelly Tatham, and today our guest is Scott Bernstein. Scott is the Director of Policy at the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition. He's a lawyer, a father, and now our very own candidate for the BC Greens in Vancouver Kingsway. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. How are you doing today with your second week in politics?
Well, it's a wild ride, as I think you know very well. It's a roller coaster, and the learning curve is steep, and we don't have a lot of time to go up it. But it feels really good. Like I'm really enjoying engaging in the issues, and just it's a lot of energy, and I'm really just amazed by the great slate of candidates for the BC Greens this year that attracted. So that's pretty inspiring to me.
It is. It's so inspiring. Every time I have this buildup of nerves and overwhelm, I reach out to someone or I look around to the other candidates. And I remember we're all in this together. We're on the right side of history. And we're stepping into a system that was designed to keep voices like ours out.
Absolutely. And I'm really, you know, I don't really know how other parties' internal relationships work, but I'm finding it's really great because we're being very supportive of each other. And, you know, people who have more experience are very open and happy to share their experience and tips. And it's just been great. Like it feels really good. And I think this is a very important election for us in BC. And it wasn't one we wanted or planned during a pandemic, but I think it's really allowing us to raise some of the differences between our party and the other parties, which is pretty important for voters.
Yeah. Had you been thinking about politics before the snap election?
Yeah, you know, sort of like everybody, every so often people like you should run for politics or something, because I'm sort of, you know, I'm opinionated. I'm actually American by birth. And so it's, people have told me, I'm more outspoken than Canadians typically are. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm personally definitely, you know, really happy to engage in issues and be out there. And people like, well, you know, and I'm, you know, I feel very strongly about a lot of issues that are very important to me. And, you know, people are like, oh, you should run for politics. So I thought about it. And then this opportunity came up with the BC Greens, and I was asked to run, and, decided to jump in the deep end.
Yeah, and I think
the real question is like, will this be the last run I do or not? Like I'll have to evaluate that. Like, what do you think?
I think we desperately need you in the system.
Yeah, I meant about you, but
oh, about me. That's a great question. You know, I've been thinking about politics for a little while and just kind of getting to the place where like, am I going to have to go into politics because things aren't changing and what else are we going to do? Right. And so I've been sitting with that, you know, well, is this a new lifetime career? Is this a 1 month thing, a 4 year thing? I don't know yet. I'm going to keep feeling it out. My challenge stepping into this role has been wanting to fulfill the role of politician and wanting to play the game properly, in that I don't want to make things worse. I don't want to mess things up. I don't want people to be like, who did the Greens bring on, this kind of crazy artist, you know? Whereas I know my ideas are, I'm reminding myself that I'm like, the system needs these ideas. We need people who are provoking. We need people who are asking the questions. And so my intention is to step into this work with the goal of shifting it, so it becomes different. So it's no longer the responsibility of one person for 50,000 people. I think the whole system needs to shift. And so what my work is changing the system. So however that means, whatever that looks for me as a politician or as a storyteller or as an activist, it's always going to be moving in this direction. So I see myself in this place for a while now. And the more I learn about how things have been going and how change hasn't being made, and the more that I'm talking to people on the ground and learning their stories, the more inspired I am to push harder and to learn more and to commit to the change that needs to happen.
Absolutely. And you're right. Like I feel like the system is in dire need of change. And I think, you know, anybody who's paying attention to anything around us is seeing that we're in a bit of a inflection point in our history and in sort of where we are as a society. And we either choose to do things differently, and better, and perhaps survive and thrive and flourish, or I think the path we're on is not a very healthy and promising one, particularly around things around the climate and our consumption of resources and different things that really affect our well-being and our health and our, you know, whether we're breathing smoky air throughout the summer, and whether people have drinking water and, you know, food to eat. I think these are all like really important and pressing issues for British Columbians and Canadians and humanity. And so we as a species sort of need to think about things differently. So I really welcome you being in here and shaking up the system. And I think your viewpoint is very valid. And I think often people, you know, politics has a bad rap because we're sort of used to politicians, you know, acting in a stereotypical way. They, you know, they promise things to us and then don't deliver. They lie to us. They are manipulative. And if more people decided to take the plunge and run and claim back power for ourselves, the system will be better. Like a democracy only works if we all sort of do our part, you know, our part being learning about the issues and voting and supporting people, but also stepping up and taking a leadership role when it's necessary in whatever thing. Not everybody is going to want to choose politics as the way to do that. But I think, you know, we can't abdicate responsibility generally for the society we live in. So we all need to learn to be leaders in our own communities in different ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because we all have that power and that drive and that capacity. We've just, it's been shaped around us that it doesn't belong to us. You know, the only reason I think I've felt the ability to go into politics is because I have politicians in my history, otherwise in my lineage. Otherwise, it's like, who even does that? You know, that's something for these older white men, or, you know, I know politics has become a lot more diverse recently, but still the institution is just very static. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your work with the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition and how that's prepared you for this role.
Sure. And so maybe I'll, if I may, let me back up a little bit. And so my background is I went back to school to get a master's degree in my 30s. So a number of years ago. And I'm one of those older white guys, sorry. But I'm, you know, I like to think I'm a millennial adjacent or something, you know, in my
thing. We need older white guys too. We need everybody.
You know, I try to recognize my privilege and make space for other voices and promote other voices as much as possible. But so my background is I went back to school to study environmental studies. And so I did a master's in environmental studies, and I was working with communities in Belize on protecting their natural resources. And I sort of, at the point I was doing my research down there, I something dawned on me, like, oh, I really needed to understand how the legal system works, because that was sort of shaping what these communities were able to do or not do. And so I decided to go and keep going and go to school and be an environmental lawyer. So I came out west here. I was born and raised in Chicago area, but I lived in Wisconsin for a decade and went to school at University of Wisconsin for my master's, but then came out here to go to UBC for law school. And so I actually did an environmental specialization, but then in my first year of law school, they encourage you to go and get a job at a law firm. And I ended up taking a job with what I didn't know was one of the foremost constitutional lawyers in Canada, Joe Arve, who was my mentor in things. And so I started working as a law student on the first real legal case I had, which was the Insight case. And so that was my first introduction really into drug policy back in 2007. And so I ended up working on that case all through the trial court at the BC Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal as an articled student, and then as a new lawyer at the Supreme Court of Canada. And so I ended up sort of putting the environmental law piece of it aside and thinking more about drug policy as a lawyer. And so I worked with Pivot Legal Society for 3 years and then ultimately went to New York and worked with a global foundation working with drug policy and nascent drug policy activists in Africa and then in the UN. And so I came back to Canada and started working with the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, which is based in the Faculty of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University. And we're a national coalition of about 55 organizations across Canada advocating for evidence-based drug policies that promote public health, human rights, and social inclusion. And so, I've been doing that for now a bit of 3.5 years. I'm the director of policy. I'm leading some national advocacy around decriminalization. I'm leading an international project called the Regulation Project .ca. .org, actually regulationproject.org, which is a international collaboration of organizations trying to talk to people about how we could legally regulate all drugs. It's a really knowledge translation type of project, among other things.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. So tell us then, how is the climate crisis related to decriminalization, drug policy, overdose crisis?
Well, I think they're all factors relating to colonialism, for one. They're all things where we have a lot of evidence of the right policies to do or to put in place, but we often don't follow them. And so I think those two similarities maybe create a situation where we think about both of these things from basically moral perspectives instead of evidence-based perspectives. And so I think for example, we could look at process of legally regulating drugs, for example, and think it from a very, moral point of, should we legalize drugs? Should we make these changes? What's the case for it? Or we could start looking to the actual concrete actions of what does it mean to legally regulate drugs? And so, for example, like who would have access to, if we decided we wanted to legally regulate heroin, for example, who would have access to it? Where would they get it? What would they do? Or where would they be able to consume it? How much would they get? Those kinds of questions. And it's similar to climate change. We could sort of, have a, if you ask somebody on the street, like, what should we do about climate change? It's a very broad, open-ended question. But if we start talking to people about questions of like, what's the optimal mix of fuel, like fossil fuels, wind, solar, nuclear, just get down to these granular level conversations with people about what's the optimal mix, and then actually look at the evidence of like, well, if we put all our eggs in fossil fuel, here's what the outcomes are. If we choose alternative fuels, here's some of the outcomes. And then we, as a society, sort of decide that these are ways we want to go. So I think there's similarity in sort of the complexity and the complexity of the issues, and also just how we sort of tend to engage in them in abstractions rather than in concrete solutions that are backed by evidence.
Mm, absolutely. So why hasn't the government been following evidence-based research that says that decriminalization is going to move us forward, is going to help people heal?
I think a lot of what we have to do is look back to the roots of drug policy prohibition, and not just in Canada, but sort of globally. But I'll focus on Canada for a second. And so, you know, up until the early 1900s, late 1800s, substances weren't restricted at all. You know, you could go and you could buy. There were a lot of, tinctures and medications and prescriptions you could get that would have opium or morphine, or they would have cocaine or cannabis extracts. And those were all readily available. People used them to treat different conditions and things. And so it was largely unregulated. People may not know this, but heroin, the word heroin is actually a brand name for a drug called diacetylmorphine, which is the brand is made by the Bayer company, like the aspirin people. It was marketed as a product for treating coughs, and like particularly as a cough suppressant, heroin, and ultimately, you know, that brand name, like, you know, like Kleenex or other things, ended up being the term we now refer to use for diacetylmorphine. But so up until like the early 1900s, these substances weren't controlled, but we decided, particularly we looked at populations of indigenous people drinking alcohol. Okay. And so that the first restrictions on alcohol focused on First Nations people and were prohibiting them from consuming alcohol on reserves. Follow that, Chinese. We had a lot of Chinese immigrants here helping with, and Japanese immigrants helping with the railroads and building things. They consumed smokable opium. And so the first legislation in Canada around narcotics was the Opium Act in 1908. And particularly it was based in racism and targeting these ethnic communities for those drugs that were criminalized, drugs that settlers and European settlers used, such as morphine tinctures and other things, were not covered under that. And so what we saw over the next 100 years was a gradual escalation in new drugs as they added cannabis in the 1920s. They started increasing around the 1960s, they dramatic, you know, in response to like the hippies and smoking cannabis and using LSD, they responded by increasing arrests and penalties. And so we were left with this system where there was this gradual ratcheting up of the war on drugs to a point where we are today, which is we're still experiencing the colonial and racist roots of the drug war, because we're looking at the primarily the people who are targeted are indigenous people and black and other racialized people of color in Canada, and those are the ones. You know, I'm a white guy. If I consume, you know, and I'm not poor, so if I'm consuming drugs, it's generally fine. I'm not going to get hassled by the police. I'm not going to be arrested. It's you know, typically the police enforcement is targeted on the marginalized people of color, poor people generally. And so I think the reason, getting to your question, long way around, the reason we don't do more is because it's terribly morally loaded topic. And so drug policy is, so not only is drug use heavily stigmatized because it's criminalized, but drug policy as a sphere of conversation is stigmatized because it's loaded with morality of this idea that, you know, drug users are bad and, you know, they are worthy of criminal punishment and all these things. And, you know, originally, again, before this criminalization, people thought of problematic substance use as a health issue. And they thought people were, you know, it wasn't regarded as a, you know, might have been like a moral failing, but it wasn't a criminal activity. You weren't a criminal for doing it. And that's where we are today, is like people who consume drugs are regarded as being criminal by many people. And let me just say this, like, statistically speaking, like, drug use is very prevalent. You know, 90% of all drug use across the world, and this is the UN statistics measuring this, is 90% is not problematic use. People use it. They use occasional. They go about their lives. They have jobs. It's not a problem.
Wow. I did not know that about the colonial racist beginnings of drug policy, but I'm not surprised considering all of the problems, it seems, on the planet have the same origins.
There were race riots in Chinatown in Vancouver that targeted the opium dens. And so they, you know, people were down there with signs and, you know, torches and like breaking windows and glass. There's some really fascinating photos on the internet of just, you know, Chinatown after one of these race riots happened there. And a lot of it was like at the core of it was drug use as targeting Chinese people as being, you know, like creating that moral situation where they're regarded as like being drug fiends and things. And it's the same in the States, largely around, you know, Black people and sort of the use of crack cocaine and this trope around, you know, crack moms and things and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. And so it started as, you know, a way, because there's so many different uses for drugs. There's using it to deal with trauma. There's using it to heal. There's using it for recreation. And as people were using it in their different ways and we put these oppressive laws on them, it just aggravated and made the situation worse and worse. I was down at Main and Terminal yesterday, and there were some folks there set up selling cannabis and mushrooms and other products. And I spoke with them a little bit and learning about how they're doing this and why they're doing this. And they just spoke very clearly to it being medicine and people needing these tools to heal. And so I feel like so much of the conversation in the public sphere is around decriminalization and kind of just getting back to maybe a ground zero from everything that we've created. And so what's next? How do we move beyond that? What are your opinions on using drugs as tools for healing?
Oh, absolutely. And so I think, you know, we have historical records dating back 10,000 years or more of people using drugs, you know, whether it's cannabis was used for thousands of years, or things like peyote or psychedelic mushrooms or other things that just grow naturally. Like people use them. It was often in a ceremony or a very spiritual relationship to the drugs because they sometimes bring about a sense of altered reality and connection with the universe in a natural way. Opium has been used for you know, centuries as a pain relief and as a healing trauma. And so I think absolutely, like we've focused a lot on that 10% of people who have problematic use with drugs as like, this is the drug problem and try to deal with it. But people vastly, like even today, would use drugs, you know, for healing pain, healing trauma. And then, you know, some drugs people use for spiritual enlightenment. And that's cannabis. Sometimes that's LSD or psychedelic mushrooms, psilocybin, or other substances are used in this way. Personally, they're used sometimes therapeutically. And so one of the negative outcomes of the war on drugs has been a stifling in research around how drugs can benefit humanity and heal humanity. And so in the 1950s and early 60s, there was this flourishing of research around psychedelic drugs, LSD, psilocybin, for example, in healing and in helping people. And when there was a crackdown on those drugs, the research funding and the support for that dried up. And so we had a dearth of research on these substances, and also cannabis too. Like there really has been a lack of research done on the beneficial uses of cannabis as a medical supplement for trauma, for pain, all kinds of different things it may help with. And so there's now lately, in the last 10, 15 years, there's been a revival in research around these. And so we now have ongoing medical studies of using MDMA and using psilocybin as therapeutic treatments. MDMA particularly is in a phase 3 trial in multiple places around the world, looking at it as a treatment for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's found to be like very, very effective. And, you know, you go through a guided therapeutic session with MDMA, and you do this a couple of times and you're healed. Like it's just gone. It's quite amazing. And so people now are pushing very strongly to have this treatment more widely available to people as a healing. Psilocybin is being researched in places, Johns Hopkins University and other, you know, major research institutes. It's being researched on as a treatment for depression. And so particularly around end of life, it helps people who are terminal come to terms with their impending death in a way that connects them to spirit and nature. And it's quite, you know, powerful. And so in Canada, there's now been some permission granted to use psilocybin for terminal patients on the island who are under the care of a doctor. So that's promising. But I think there's, you know, again, we focus so much on the perceived harms of drug use that we rarely have enough conversation talking about what the benefits are and why people use them, have used them for millennia.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. So it's not just, it's destigmatization and decriminalization is step one. And then step two is recognizing that there are so many beneficial uses. It can heal us faster. We have the tools to heal society. We have the tools to bring people out of depression and trauma and PTSD.
Right. And underlying it, you know, I think when we look at, people who have substance use disorder or have, you know, concurrent mental health issues and well, like often at the root of this is trauma. And so people sometimes take drugs to check out and to cope with a very difficult living situation. I think we need to approach that situation with compassion and with thinking about the underlying factors. Like we can't just look at the drug use as the issue. We have to look at like why people are using drugs and treat them. You know, they're using drugs sometimes because they don't have houses, because they were abused as young people, because they're have other concurrent mental health issues, because they're poor. Like these are issues that are larger societal issues that are the, you know, social determinants of public health that we think about. And so, you know, getting it back to the politics, like I think as a society, you know, we have the choices about where we allocate money and where, what kinds of things we support. And I think we really need to be thinking more about lifting people up and not just quick fix solutions or sound bites. We actually need to restructure society in a way that allows us to thrive, allows us to flourish in a space that's healthier.
Absolutely. 100%. You have my vote. If I could vote for you.
I'd vote for you too if I could. But
We're on the same page about all of this, and I'm so grateful to be in conversation with you and to just to know that all of the solutions are out there, because I think so many people are looking at the situation in our city and to many places in the world and feeling hopeless, that it's too hard, that the overdose crisis is getting worse, that we can't find people homes. And hearing this and knowing that the tools are there, and it's just a matter of having the policymakers in place who are coming from a place of compassion, who are trusting the evidence, who are rewriting the racist laws, this all can be done. It's all solvable. So thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a great, really enjoyable having a conversation with you.
Good. And so for those of you in Vancouver Kingsway and just in general who want to learn more about Scott and his work, you can check out bcgreens.ca/Scott_Bernstein. And he's on Twitter @Scott_Byrne. Is there anywhere else people can find you or anything else you want to leave us before we say?
I have a Facebook page, Scott_4Kingsway. I appreciate anybody who's living in Kingsway voting for me. I'm also very open to discussing issues, and you know, if people have questions, I'm trying to really engage. It's very difficult during a pandemic, but I'm trying to engage people as well as I can to hear issues of importance to people all over the city and do what I can to help.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks, Callie.